welcome to Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM Channel 130. Of course, our radio show is also a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org or directly to wherever you listen to your podcast.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I am your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we are happy to have with us today Dominican Father Thomas Petrie. He is a well-known voice to EWTN radio listeners and a known face on the broadcast side of things as well. And Father, we'd love to chat with you today about some very interesting facts about our new Pope Leo XIV, who is from Chicago. As a Chicagoan, I'm now required under canon law to mention that every time. We are thankful that you could be with us today.
I'm always happy to be with you. It's great to be here.
So, Father, I think we have to start with this really incredibly important fact is that you and the friars had kind of a bracket going on and that you won the name contest. You were able to guess the name correctly. That's really interesting. Why did you think the new Holy Father would choose that particular name?
Well, we did have a bracket going on. I think other religious houses do the similar thing. I think it's illegal under canon law to gamble on who might become pope, but there's nothing against trying to figure out what the name is going to be. So, yeah, I chose Leo XIV. It was a combination of both wishful thinking and an educated guess. You know, it was wishful thinking because it seems to me that the last several pontificates since the Second Vatican Council, so John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, John Paul the 2nd, Benedict, and now Francis, have been in some ways rehashing and interpreting the council, and there's been different factions associated with each of them. And sometimes even operating out of 1960s or 1970s theology or a reaction to those theologies. And quite honestly, I just wanted to get off the merry-go-round. I want to go back somewhere before the council, not to discredit the council, but just to say, we got to move on at some point here. We got to stop the navel gazing. So that was the wishful side of things. But the more educated side was that, and hopeful, I think, was that Leo XIII was Pope during a very difficult time in both the church and in the world. He was the first truly modern Pope. You know, he was the first Pope to live really in the Vatican voluntarily. Pius IX was the last Pope to have the Papal States, lived at the Quirinal Palace, as most previous popes before him did. And Pope Leo XIII was the greatest, probably the one of the greatest teaching popes in the church's history, and really outlined at a time when the world was experiencing a lot of political upheaval, revolutions, and the church was diminished in its influence in the world, just really highlighted how Catholics are supposed to move forward in the modern world. And it seems to me that we're kind of at a similar place now, you know, with the world in upheaval, a lot of confusion in the church. And I dare say even some, probably at the late 19th century as well, some despair perhaps about the state of things, the state of the church or the state of the world. So I was really kind of prayerful and hopeful for a Leo XIV. And I was obviously thrilled. I mean, I was listening to the Habemus Papam and I missed the Leonis part, but I caught the number in Latin. And so I distinctly heard 14. I was like, oh my gosh, it's Leo XIV. That's awesome.
Father Petrie, the first encyclical I ever read as a Catholic was Rerum Novarum, which was written by this Pope's namesake's predecessor, Leo XIII. And, you know, I think people rush to jump into, oh, he's, you know, going to pick up with this and it's going to be about workers. And I was intrigued to see that, in fact, he said he wants to confront artificial intelligence and AI and the technological revolution. And that made so much sense because if you think about it, other than, you know, the sexual revolution and the industrial revolution, the technological revolution, if we want to call it that, has probably been the most disruptive thing to humanity, to our lives. It certainly brought about great goods, but also huge human costs. What do you see as some of the biggest things that the Pope might want to tackle on that front?
Well, I think that's a great question, Ashley. And I think, you know, I had not put that together, and I'm grateful that you put that together, because you're right. I mean, it is a revolution. There is great good, just like there was good in the Industrial Revolution. And in some sense, certain goods in the sexual revolution, if we want to regard certain understandings of love as good versus ones that are bad. But yeah, the technological revolution is not just about AI, it seems to me, or programs or robots or software. And Pope Francis talked a little bit about this. He never really went into detail about it, but it's also the rise of what we might call a technocracy, right? In which people are reduced to simply coders and programmers and set aside for the efficiency of computing. And I suspect, and this is what one of Pope Leo XIII's great insights was with regard to labor and workers, that that the dignity of work means that the human person is actually contributing something and puts an impression of himself or herself, the worker, there's something of the worker in the product that they're creating, that they're making, and that invests a certain amount, equivocally speaking, of a certain dignity in the product. And, you know, already here at the House of Studies, we've had some conferences on St. Thomas Aquinas, theology, and artificial intelligence. And there's a great deal of worry about how fast artificial intelligence is growing and where it might go. But we do know that at the base level, artificial intelligence isn't able to do what humans can do, which is to take in experiences through our five senses, to amalgamate them and to reflect on them, that in fact, computers still require and will always in some sense require the human experience to do what they do. They will require the data of humans to do what they do. But at the same time, we want to make sure that people remain free and that AI remains at the service of healthy lifestyles, at the service of the common good, and at the service of the human person.
Father, Pope Leo XIII, I believe, was the first pope to be captured on film, and, you know, which was a wonderful thing to be able to go back and see actually images of him in that way. And then Pope Leo XIV met with journalists the other day and was the first to be able to address them in English as a primary language. And English has now, I think, really surpassed French as being the international language that everyone knows. And he also spoke very movingly to the journalists about those among them who were imprisoned for telling the truth about stories. Was there anything else in the Holy Father's message to the media that was striking to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, he sort of asked them to always be for the truth and to find the truth and to tell the truth. I mean, I'm still in some ways, like I suspect like all of us here and all of us in the United States, just stunned that we have a pope whose first language is English. You know, the last pope was Pope Adrian VI, I think, somewhere in the 1400s. He was the only British pope. But it's really remarkable because now we have a pope. We know what Italians feel like, that and Poles and Argentinians and Germans, that he's got cousins and nephews and family who are going to, I presume, like he's got family who are still school age going to school. And my cousin's the Pope, my uncle's the Pope. I mean,
mm-hmm. Both of his brothers have been doing all
both
these
of
media.
His brothers, yes. You know, who he joked with the journalists have been on TV more than he has, you know.
So, and they've been delightful. I've called. I've let like you. I've made a prediction. I think they're going to have their own talk show by the end of the month. You know, Lou and John Pope-splaining or something like that. But they're really fun characters.
I think that the two of them and Pope Leo XIV, and you see this already in how Pope Leo XIV works, and they seem to have a really true bond, those three brothers, which obviously says their parents did something really well, you know, in raising them. But also Pope Leo XIV really exudes a sort of love and humility and a charity just by his expression, mm-hmm. you know? And I think we needed that. I mean, I personally am over the last week thinking to myself, just seeing a younger Pope. I mean, he's 68, 69, right? But when's the last time we've really seen a vigorous Pope walking around unhindered, you know, unhindered by old age? And it's the 1990s, really, with John Paul II before he started to get ill, right? And I forgot what that looks like. And it's I think it's going to be very invigorating, both for the church, but also for the church in the United States.
And then his love for sports, which is very natural. It's nothing contrived. There's video of him now at Chicago White Sox games by himself wearing a White Sox jersey. And he met with tennis players yesterday. And so I think that speaks to a lot of young people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I really do feel that, the Holy Spirit was really working in this. And this is, of course, I want to be clear, not to take anything away from Pope Francis. I mean, I think Pope Francis had a wonderful pastoral heart. I think he was very good for the mission of the church. I think he did want the church to get away from navel gazing. The synodality thing, I think, went sideways. I mean, there's evidence that he wasn't always pleased with how the synods were going. I think because there's a temptation in those to do too much navel gazing. What can the church change? What can we do? When really we need to walk with Christ and introduce people to Christ in all walks of life, in all places. And the difficulty was, I think, under Pope Francis, is that I think he did leave a lot of people in confusion. You know, I don't think that's critical. I think every pope has gifts and weaknesses. John Paul and Benedict, not excluded from that. And I believe that Pope Leo XIV carries the pastoral heart, the missionary zeal of Francis, but he'll also have clarity. I mean, the man has a doctorate in canon law, and he majored in mathematics and science. Mm-hmm. You don't do that unless you have a brain for that likes precision and clarity.
You know, speaking of the synods, he mentioned synodality in his first remarks to the world, which Mary and I happen to be in St. Peter's Square for. But, you know, I think we all kind of agree that the synods didn't exactly, or their end result was probably more confusion, less unity within the church. What do you see as kind of a path forward for them? How does the Pope kind of steer the church forward, you know, and bring Catholics closer together while still dealing with this kind of issue hanging out there? And especially the fact that, you know, you have the Germans already lunging forward saying, let's keep going with the synodality.
Yeah, well, I think the Germans, I mean, are going to have to be dealt with. I mean, I think that's kind of obvious. They're going to have to be dealt with. And Francis was trying to deal with them. It'll be interesting to see how a Pope who is a canon lawyer will have a different tact, or might have a different tact. You know, the synodality thing, I think it sounded like a lot of corporate jargon, I think, for a lot of people. There was a lot of jargon there. And I think the Holy Father, Pope Francis, was never actually precise on what he thought the synodality was. He was letting cardinals and different people speak about it. I went to Quito with EWTN for the International Eucharistic Congress, and it was absolutely wonderful. But they spent a whole day, and one day's theme was the synodality of the Eucharist. What is that, right? And so what I realized in that whole week, though, was that the whole focus of that Eucharistic Congress and the day on synodality was simply about helping the lay faithful take up their mission as baptized members of the church to reach the world and to take ownership of their apostolic mission, their evangelical mission in the world, and to find ways to do that together and in accompaniment. Cardinal Prevost, Pope Leo XIV, gave an hour-long interview 9 months ago at a parish in Illinois, and someone asked him about this. And it was interesting. He made a very similar comment. He said that synodality actually has been going on in lots of places in America or in the world for many, many years. And I'm sure he's talking about the American experience. It's not like we don't have laity involved in decision-making in the United States. I mean, they're involved at all levels in the United States already, right? But that's not true everywhere. And I think when we hear synodality, we hear corporate jargon. The Germans obviously hear, oh, we can change this, we can do this, we're going to have more power, you know. the Latin Americans here, it means walking with the church. I think Cardinal Prevost said, synodality is nothing more than Lumen Gentium, the Vatican's constitution on the church in action. That's what it should be. And that seems to me to be the right way to go. Now, my question is, why do we need to invent all of this new language? Let's just use the language of the Second Vatican Council of the Church, that the people of God are meant to be the evangelizers. I can see why that would need to be emphasized in a place like Latin America, where probably a lot of Catholics think it's the priest's job to go out on the streets and evangelize. I think in the United States, we have that message. In Germany, they still seem to be doing a lot of navel gazing. You know, Italians, maybe they need to also hear that kind of message. So I suspect synodality will continue, but I really do anticipate we're going to see it under a different mode or a different register, as you might say.
Well, Father, when most American Catholics, at least, think of religious communities of men, they think of the big three, right? The Jesuits, the Franciscans, and the Dominicans. The Holy Father is from the Augustinians, which is a much smaller religious order. I think there's only 3,000 priests worldwide. How do you think the particular charism of the Augustinians will impact his papacy? And can you explain to the listeners who might not be familiar with the community what their particular charism is?
Right. So the Augustinians and the Dominicans and the Franciscans have a very similar background. We were all founded in the 13th century, and we were part of a new type of religious order called mendicancy. We're all mendicants. And it was the first kind of religious order of men who weren't monks, who weren't just staying in the abbey or staying in the monastery to pray, but were basically monks. We live like monks, but we're in the world too. So someone once said, you know, the mendicants are kind of like monks on the move. We're always monks on the move, you know. And the Augustinians were founded in that sort of context during the 13th century, when bishops and diocesan priests were really not living the good life. You know, they were not preaching. They were not necessarily present to their people. And so all of these movements in one way or the other, was the Franciscans, the Dominicans, or the Augustinians, the Carmelites were also part of the mendicant movement, were emphasizing different aspects of that August, of that Christian vision of community and evangelization that we hear about in the Acts of the Apostles. The Augustinians follows Saint Augustine. And so, and their charism is really, you know, being faithful to the early church, being faithful to the mission of the church, however it takes them, whether that's with the poor, whether that's with in parish ministry or missionary work, whether that's teaching. And what you're going to see is a very strong attachment to the theology and writings of St. Augustine. And I think we saw that in Pope Leo XIV's first homily to the cardinals. It was decidedly Christocentric, and you saw the primacy of grace, so much so that Pope Leo XIV reminded the cardinals that the Pope is simply the steward of the mysteries that he's been given and is intended to pass on, and that, in fact, the Pope should recede, should diminish, so that Christ can actually shine through. And that's a very Augustinian, just the primacy of grace. And I think, and I don't remember exactly how he concluded the homily, but it was something to the effects of, pray that I will always have the grace to do this. The Augustinians and I, you know, St. Dominic, the Dominicans, we follow St. Thomas Aquinas, who was certainly a faithful student, a devotee of St. Augustine. And I would argue the Dominicans, there's no order in the church that places a higher primacy on grace than the Dominican order. But if there is one, it would be the Augustinians, as opposed to a spirituality that without falling into heresy might emphasize activity more, you know, and what we can do more than what grace might do. And of course, mm-hmm. you run into the problem there of a possible Pelagianism or a semi-Pelagianism.
Well, my understanding is the Holy Father has a connection to the Dominicans in that he did his doctoral thesis at the Angelicum. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so that's exciting. Father Thomas Joseph White is the rector of the Angelicum, and he's a Dominican from our province, and he and I entered the novitiate together. So I'm really happy to see he's already scrounged around and found Father Prevost's doctoral dissertation. And he points out and others have started to point this out, that in the doctoral dissertation, which is on the authority of a prior or the superior of an Augustinian community, that authority is always about service and serving in charity for St. Augustine. Authority is never an end in itself. And so it's wonderful that, you know, that that's sort of in his background. As a young priest, he was already wondering what it means to be a superior and what authority means in the Augustinian tradition. And I mean, in this sense, to say it's the Augustinian tradition, it's not, that's the truth. It's true that authority is about service. And I suspect we're already seeing elements of that in this first week of Pope Leo XIV's pontificate.
And Father, in the Holy Father's new coat of arms, there's a very prominent fleur-de-lis in honor of Our Lady. And, you know, when I think of the rosary or, you know, devotion to Our Lady, I really think of the Dominicans first. Can you speak a little bit about why the Holy Father might have placed that emphasis in his papal coat of arms?
Well, I think it's important that, look, the Blessed Mother is our way to the Son in many ways, right? I mean, she's our mother. And the fact that he made a pilgrimage already to the Augustinian Marian shrine, the fact that Francis did that routinely to Our Lady of the Salus Romani and Santa Maria Maggiore, Benedict. And I mean, I would love to see this kind of continue on where we're getting these Marian elements in the papals or custom, where there's a pilgrimage to Mary to offer your pontificate to her, where there's some element of her in your coat of arms. Of course, popes have been doing this for a long time in their encyclicals and letters, always concluding with some address or invocation of the Blessed Mother. And so I think just having the Blessed Mother, if there is a Petrine, to quote von Balthasar, you know, Hans Urs von Balthasar, one of the great 20th century theologians, if there's a Petrine dimension to the church, the Marian dimension is in fact greater, because Mary pulls into herself all that is good about not only being the premier disciple, but also being the one who brings the word to the world. She's the one who gives birth to the word in the world.
Father, we're running out of time, but one question that I've been asking a lot of our recent guests is, it's clear that America's having a real Catholic moment. And this I was, you know, saying before we just had the first American Pope elected, but, you know, this last Easter, it seemed like every single parish in America was just bursting at the seams with record numbers of new converts. And I know social media can maybe amplify that a little bit or distort reality, but you know, just, you know, speaking of media, something that our new Holy Father clearly seems to care about, you know, just the new and interesting media outlets, the Hallow app. And you yourself are a teacher to young people. You're right next to the Catholic University of America. What do you think is driving this Catholic moment right now in America?
Well, I'm going to try to answer this succinctly. I think you're right. I think we are in a Catholic moment. I think back to that wonderful radio address that Joseph Ratzinger gave in 1968 about the church and faith in the future. This is the famous place where he famously said that he thought the church would be a smaller church going, you know, in the future. But that's not really the point of that address, of his message. He spends time going through history, that the church and the world go through these cycles where the church loses influence and the world gains and secular society gains prominence. But that can only go on for so long, because the human person desires meaning. The human person is made for God, right? And so he says that every time this has happened, eventually, and this is my language, not his, that society goes over a cliff. It hits a wall of a desire for meaning and a desire for something that's greater and transcendent. And that's when God historically has always raised up like unique saints that speak to the world at that moment. And so, you know, when we look at the world, I think as Catholics, and we look at even our own country and other countries, it can be very easy to fall into the temptation of despair and to think, gosh, how can we get over some of this polarization? I mean, even some of the transgenderism, and I mean, some of it is so absurd. How can we get over that? And I think the message of the church, and this was certainly a strong message of Pope Benedict XVI, and I think we'll see it in Pope Leo XIV, is that it is by being faithful to the graces of God, and that God ultimately will be the one to solve these issues and this problem in the end. That's why Ratzinger said that Christians, he didn't think, were allowed to be either pessimist or optimist, that we were rather supposed to be people of hope, because hope, optimism says we can get our way out of this. Pessimism says, no, we can't. Hope says, I can't, but God can, and he has promised to do so. And so it's also kind of remarkable that we're in the middle of this Jubilee pilgrimage of hope, that we receive this new Pope who clearly is going to emphasize grace and the primacy of God in evangelizing and changing the world.
Well, Father, we just have about a minute and a half left, but I'd like to ask you, because Ashley and I were in Rome when all of this happened, so we didn't get to see some of the video of different religious communities and schools and stuff finding out. Where were you when you heard the news, and who were you with, and what was it like?
Well, I was in this very seat. I was in my office, and I was actually doing an interview for a major secular news outlet, and I had the Vatican camera on my computer so I could see what was going with the smokestack, and I noticed it before the anchors did, and they were outside on one of the roofs, and they turned around. He's like, he's right, it's smoke, it's white smoke. So it was really, really remarkable.
Yeah, it was just an electrifying moment. And still, I think we're just still all just basking in the joy of it all. So, well, Father Thomas Petrie, thank you so much for giving us so much time this morning. And if you'd like to learn more about the Dominican House of Studies, please visit dhs.edu. And you can follow Father Thomas Petrie on social media at Petrie, that's P-E-T-R-I-O-P. And make sure to visit thecatholicassociation.org to learn all about us. And thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Mary Fiorito.
And this weekend marks a very exciting event in our nation's capital, the annual Eucharistic procession organized by the Catholic Information Center, the third of its kind. It will be taking place on May 17th, and we have the director of the CIC who is organizing this wonderful event with us today, Father Charles Trulos. Welcome back to the show, Father Charles.
Thank you, Ashley, and thank you, Mary, for having me on.
So I would love to hear all about this event, but first, we kind of can't help with all of our guests talking about the momentous occasion of the election of our new Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV, and would love to get your thoughts on this man, the fact that he's the first from the United States. You're someone who's not from the United States, but you've lived here for many, many years. What was your reaction when you saw him come out on that balcony?
Well, I was very excited, first of all. To be completely honest, I didn't know much about him before. And I was running to the CIC when I was out. And then I heard about the white smoke, and we had prepared some Prosecco and some celebration at the Catholic Information Center. Many people came in from downtown Washington, D.C. to see the new Pope, who that person was going to be, because the excitement and the anticipation of the new Pope, it's one of the most amazing events, I think, in our times. And when we heard the name and the fact that he was born in Chicago, right, and that he was an American, and so everyone, you know, was so excited. And I think that with his background as an American, and also as having been a missionary and having been in so many countries and having worked in Rome and at the Dicastery of Bishops, I think he has a global understanding of the Church that gives him kind of an authority and an understanding of what the needs of the Church are at this present time. So I'm very excited. And let's see how all develops, right? But the Holy Spirit is always behind this, behind the Church, behind the Pope, working, you know, beautiful things. So I'm very happy.
Father, what do you think it is about the election of the new Holy Father that that quite literally moves people to tears. Ashley and I had the great privilege of being in St. Peter's Square when the announcement came out, and there was a woman standing nearby who also spoke English and who kind of turned to me and said, "I don't even know why I'm crying. I'm not Catholic." But she was so moved by the moment. And obviously there's a lot of pageantry and ritual that is part of this. But I get the sense there's something more deeply spiritual going on. Can you speak to that particular piece of it?
I had the same experience with other people who I know, friends of mine, acquaintances were not Catholic, and they were also very, very happy and excited about the new Pope, even if they didn't know who that person was. And I think that has to do with the fact that the Pope represents Christ, right? He's the vicar of Christ here on earth, and he has a special role in caring spiritually for all mankind, for everyone, regardless of their background, where they come from. And that, you know, that is felt, I think, in our society. All the popes that we have had, you know, in the recent centuries have been, you know, in this regard, very committed. Any pope, right, in history is the vicar of Christ. And so this is something that I think that people understand and cherish, regardless of whether they are Catholic or not Catholic.
Absolutely. Well, Father, in my neighborhood, I live in a very Catholic neighborhood, and every year we have a little mini Eucharistic procession. And it's, you know, similar to the Pope. It kind of gathers the intrigue of people going by, especially frustrated cars that, you know, we actually close down some streets and people set up altars in their driveways and we make stops along the way. But you certainly, you know, similar to the election of a new pope, you get a sense of the tradition, the pageantry, and the kind of mystical beauty of the church that's just very different than everything else in our modern times. But you have been organizing and running that on a much larger scale in downtown Washington, D.C. So tell us, tell our listeners what exactly this entails, like logistically, and then what your experience has been with this procession in the streets of our nation's capital.
Well, I think that I have to say that all this started 3 years ago or 2 years ago when the Eucharistic revival hit our country with it was providence, right? God's providence, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops decided to that we all should push in this direction. And then I kind of came to mind the Eucharistic processions that I used to attend when I was a boy in Spain, and also all the stories of other Eucharistic processions in different parts of Europe, and how the Eucharistic revival was encouraging this aspect. And I, you know, at the Catholic Information Center, we decided that this was the moment to start this event of faith in our nation's capital, which is a very important place for our country and very significant. So we organized the organization of this Eucharistic procession is really intense and you know, it's some kind, and logistically speaking, complicated, because you have to, there are many different groups of elements that need to come together. And the civil authorities, because they close the streets, they protect us, the law enforcement, right? But also we have so many volunteers, so many staff members, so many people attending the procession. And we want also to have a beautiful, beautiful showing of our faith in the real presence of Jesus Christ. So also the liturgy plays a fundamental role here in making this procession something very beautiful and attractive for everyone, because they can see the goodness and the beauty of God and Jesus Christ in how we proceed with the Blessed Sacrament. So it's a complicated, I didn't anticipate how complicated this was, because, you know, a small Eucharistic procession can be kind of simpler, but this one involves so many people. And anyway, but I'm so happy to be able to be a part of it.
Father, one of the other interesting things about this time this year is that in addition to having a new Holy Father, which is very exciting, we have our first Catholic vice president, or I shouldn't say our first Catholic vice president, but we have a Catholic vice president who's a convert and very enthusiastic about his faith. But also it's the year of hope. It's this Jubilee year of hope. So will the Jubilee theme play a role in the procession this year?
Absolutely, yes. So I was very happy when Pope Francis announced the title or the topic of this Jubilee year 2025, right? That is celebrated every 25 years. I remember the previous one I was in Rome myself, studying for the priesthood in the year of, you know, in the year 2000. It was an amazing event. And this year, I thought of the Jubilee year because it's a year of rejoicing, of joy, of bringing hope. And we normally, right, one of the elements of the Jubilee year, especially those who go to Rome, but also in different capitals of different states and dioceses, and there are these holy doors, right, when you pass through, right, to express your desire to be renewed and to convert and to start over. And I thought that the Eucharist is not just passing through a door, but is bringing hope itself to the streets of our nation's capital. When people see Jesus Christ and see the faith that we express through our devotion, through our prayers, I think that we all kind of are lifted up and are renewed in the sense of hope that we can really go to heaven despite our difficulties, our own weaknesses and limitations, and that God is merciful. And that's a beautiful thing to see physically when we process with the Eucharist.
You read that one of the places you will stop, you make stops along the way, is the Department of Veterans Affairs, and you'll pray for service members and their families. Are there any other specific places you stop or specific, like uniquely American prayer intentions that you make?
Yeah, we pass by different historical landmarks, right? We are passing through Farragut Square, MacPherson Square, Lafayette Square, and those are, I think, historically speaking, very important elements for our country, because they represent the independence of our country, and then in the Civil War, right, with General MacPherson and the first admiral of the Navy, David Farragut. So, and then of course Lafayette, that, right, like a foreign military officer who fought alongside George Washington for the Revolutionary War. And I think that in passing by these places, we are, and especially in view of the White House, that's another, of course, right? That represents in some way the care of our country that and the common good that the executive branch should always care for, right? We are praying for our country, for the people of our country, not regardless of where they come from, different states, and for our government and our leaders, so that they can always make decisions in the light of God's love. Those are elements that this Eucharistic procession. This procession is so unique, I think.
And Father, do you have any stories from previous years' processions about conversions that may have taken place, or something that you feel is very noteworthy that you would like to share with our listeners?
It's beautiful to see how many people stop, you know, in the streets to see this event that they have never seen before in their lives. And at the beginning, they are wondering what this is, and they ask. And then the people in the procession, they kind of come out and they start explaining our faith and what the Eucharist means for us, for our Catholics, how the real presence of Jesus is there. And I think it is very moving to see that. But I have to tell you something. I remember passing by a big building with windows, and then this person was hanging on in the middle of the facade, you know, cleaning windows, right? Hanging. I mean, he was really high,
right?
And then when he saw the Eucharistic procession, he turned around, and then he removed his hat and started to pray from that altitude, right, from that height, which was so beautiful to see, because in Europe, the tradition has always been that when the Eucharistic procession passes through a street, the different balconies of the houses, and they all decorate the different facades, and people come out from their houses. So that reminded me of those images of the past. And also it reminded me, or I would say came to mind, right, it's coming to mind right now, how Pope Leo XIV in Peru, when during the pandemic, he came out to the streets of the city by himself, walking by himself with a few other priests, you know, all separated. And he was blessing all the streets of the city with the monstrance, with the Eucharist. And that's really moving to see that from the Pope.
Yeah, and following the Pope's funeral and his death, many people referenced that moment as being one of the most significant moments for them of his papacy, that he came out and blessed the world and was praying for the world. And, you know, during that interregnum when there is no Holy Father, that's the kind of like spiritual protection you feel you don't have, because there's no Holy Father to pray for the world that way. So that's very beautiful, Father. Thank you.
The other thing I wanted to say is the fact that the Pope was or is a fan of the White Sox. This is what I hear, right? I used to live in Chicago, and I think that the first professional baseball game I have ever been to, it was a White Sox game against the Yankees. And you know, I don't know why it makes the Pope very close to me personally, right? And at the same time, I'm thinking of the Eucharistic processions, because we want the Eucharistic processions to be also very kind of a common scene in the life of the church. And I see that many churches are now implementing or having more, you know, especially on Corpus Christi. So it's a beautiful thing to see in America.
We've also just seen the end of this extensive Eucharistic pilgrimage all over the country, multiple different routes. And the thing that I was most struck by with the different images and stories coming out of that was how youthful they were, how many young people were leading the way. And you're someone who works with a lot of young people. You're in a downtown professional urban area. Are you seeing what we keep reading about, which is this, in addition to a Eucharistic revival, really a youthful revival in the church with young people? You know, I know the CIC runs the Leonine Forum, which seems like it's just exploded. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing firsthand with young people in this country, young Catholics.
See, I am in a very fortunate place, because this is exactly what you just described is what I have been seeing recently. So many young people coming back to the faith, not just coming back to the faith, but growing in their faith in downtown Washington, D.C., young professionals or, you know, fathers or mothers with their children, it's kind of flourishing. And in the also the attendance that we have at the Daily Mass at the Catholic Information Center, which is a small chapel by the White House, as you may know. And then I'm there every day for hearing confessions, for instance, and giving spiritual direction. And we have programs and events. And it's the Leonine Forum that you mentioned, which is a great program to teach the social teaching of the church to young professionals. So it's so beautiful to see that makes my you know, ministry something that I enjoy so much. And I'm very thankful to God for the place where I am. I have always been involved with young people, but especially this place is wonderful.
Well, we thank you so much for your time and for bringing Christ's presence to the streets to be close with the people. And certainly we'll be praying for a successful event. Where can our listeners find out more about your work and even about the details of the event?
You can find more at our website at cicdc.org and also through our social media. And we will be processing, you know, with the Eucharistic procession on Saturday, whether it rains or it, you know, shines. But I think it's going to be sunny, a sunny day. So anyway.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Father Charles.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yes, in D.C., they are kicking off the CIC Eucharistic procession this weekend, but also beginning is the last leg of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, going from Indianapolis to Los Angeles. Marina Frattaroli, a perpetual pilgrim on the Seton route last summer, shares with us what walking the entire journey meant to her.
What caught my attention about the Eucharist was on Twitter, way back when, was the words National Eucharistic Revival. And so those words really were the ones I was like, what is that? Like, what does that mean? And I Googled it. And that's when I re-encountered the word Eucharist after a really long time. And when I framed in the context of revival, it was really meaningful to me as a Protestant. Mm-hmm. I just so much coalesced when I did that research. I saw like, this is a central tenet of the Catholic faith. This is something that even the bishops are admitting, like not every Catholic fully grasps. And that was all very helpful context to me as someone who had been to some masses before, had known some Catholics, though not. And so it made me have to wrestle with it. Like, you know, like, what is this revival? Why are they doing it? What is the Eucharist? What are the implications of that really big claim on a Christian's devotional life? You know, so when the National Eucharistic Revival was launching this pilgrimage, it was really near to my heart already, mm-hmm. because I thought that the National Eucharistic Revival was like really powerful for conversion, because it really set mine into place, or it initiated that. And so I knew it was going to be a big challenge because I was graduating law school and I have a lot to do with that, and with the bar and with working. But technically, the dates fit. Technically, there was not anywhere I had to be during the exact dates of the pilgrimage and then the Eucharistic Congress. So I applied, and I was so busy during that time that I honestly just, I gave myself like an hour and a half to type out that application, to write all those essays. I'm just like, if it's God's will, he'll put me on this pilgrimage. But, you know, I wasn't able to like, to really edit things how I wanted to. And it was just like, I really left it to God and I was accepted. And I prayerfully chose to do it. But it was a risk and it was a sacrifice. But it was absolutely not unrewarded. And I'm so glad I made that 65-day journey. What I witnessed in America during that time was, I would say, true revival. I saw people who were already faithful receive deep encouragement. I myself spoke to people, several people, many people, for the first time, the teaching of the Eucharist. And so I just saw so many people like kind of gain new life in their faith. And I saw so many seeds be planted. And I'm just so excited, about what happened that summer. And I'm excited there's going to be another pilgrimage this summer as well.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm joined by our dear colleague, Monsignor Roger Landry, who I was with not too long ago in Rome for the historic election of the first American Pope. And so he remains in Rome with much work to do as a new pontificate begins. So welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Ashley. It was great to have you here in Rome.
So, Monsignor, there's so many questions that people have, and there's so much to be seen. But one thing that we know is the Holy Father's new name. And so tell us a little bit about the significance of the choice of the name Leo.
So he described why he took the name Leo. Always when a pope takes a name, you're wondering what the reason was. And he told the cardinals whom he convened the day after his election why he chose it, because he wanted to link his papacy to that of Pope Leo XIII, who was Pope from 1878 to 1903. And Pope Leo wrote Rerum Novarum, he's the father of Catholic social teaching, in order to take the light of Catholic moral theology and apply it to the industrial age. And so our new Pope Leo XIV, he wanted to take the light of the church's teaching and apply it to the new digital age, especially to artificial intelligence, that these are going to be big time questions coming forward. Many are already raising them. And he doesn't want the church to be on the sideline of that, but he wants it to be right in the center, basically bringing the church's treasury of the understanding of human beings and how they're going to relate to the questions of intelligence and work. He wants to bring the ethical dimension into the use of AI. He wants to bring the full set of the church's 2,000-year-old wisdom to the questions that are coming. So that's why he said he took the name. But for me, when we look at the name Leo, we have the Latin word for lion. And so I am hoping that we're going to have a massively courageous successor of St. Peter leading us during this age in which so many people are afraid, so many are anxious, so many need to hear Jesus telling us again, have no fear, I'm with you, it is I.
Monsignor, I wasn't able to watch your coverage for EWTN as his election was announced because I was standing underneath you in the scaffolding in St. Peter's Square. But I just have to ask, were you shocked? Were you as shocked as so many Americans were when his name was announced?
I really was. As soon as Cardinal Dominique Mamberti put that word Robert, I knew that there were four Roberts in the college, and I didn't think any of the other three would have been chosen. When he said Franciscum, he was the only Robert Francis. And then later, Prevost. And even though I knew that those names were coming, I still couldn't believe that we had an American. My mouth was agape. The eyeballs on my teammates on the EWTN set were about to pop through dilation. And it's just, even several days later, I'm still getting used to the reality that a successor of St. Peter was baptized not in the Jordan, but in Chicago. That's where he made his first confession, Holy Communion. That's where he received the Holy Spirit to strengthen him for the work he's now doing. And so I'm so proud of the church in America that's produced this type of mature fruit, whose faith, raised in our own country, is now going to nourish the world.
Well, I must say, as a mom of baseball fans, it's also very exciting and hard for my kids to believe that there's actual footage of the Holy Father at a World Series game in a White Sox jersey. But I so agree with you about the sense of pride. And I think there's nothing wrong with being proud that America produced a new pope. And certainly it seems as though there's sort of a new a Catholic revival going on in the American church.
To be proud is to be grateful, above all to God, that he has chosen one of the members of our family in the United States to become Pope. He's not a stranger. He was nourished on the same sacraments and Word of God and culture we were nourished by. And so if the Lord has an exalted vocation for Robert Francis Prevost, imagine what he has for Ashley Samuelson McGuire and Monsignor Roger Landry. The Lord who called him is calling us, and he's calling all our listeners to be able to say yes to whatever his plans are for our life, the same way this son of the south side of Chicago has said yes repeatedly to the Lord who continues to call.
Truly exciting times. We thank you so much for joining us, Monsignor Landry.
Talk to you next week.